And some of the things that I work on in quantum gravity, I think may be relevant for some problems in quantum foundations, mostly the measurement problem. I think there's some intersection between issues with the problem of time or resolutions of the problem of time and the resolutions of measurement problem. And so, okay, let me begin. So I'll give a very brief introduction to what the problems that I am trying to solve here. So, you know, imagine, I don't know if you guys have seen this TV show. I've heard of it. I haven't seen it, I promise. But apparently people send in these questions and this doctor answers, mostly about medical issues, I think. But I was wondering, you know, what would I answer, someone that is actually a doctor in quantum gravity would answer from this question? What do we actually want from quantum gravity? And it's not that clear cut. I think different people aim for different things. So some standard possibilities would be someone just saying, well, we just want some theory that, you know, encompasses QFT and GR and includes effects in the Planck constant, in Newton's gravitational constant, and the speed of light. But we, you know, effective field theory already gives a perturbative quantum gravity effects up to certain energies, which include these three constants. And so maybe, you know, you could shift the goalpost and say, well, I want a perturbatively renormalizable gravitational action, maybe around a classical background or something like that. But we also have theories that claim to do that.
Are you putting a tick saying that there are no questions? No.
Okay. So maybe, you know, to answer your question, maybe should also resolve singularities, have only spin two gravitons, have some cosmological implications. And here we falter. There's more difficulty. But even then, I'm not going to touch on those problems. Following this nomenclature that I don't know if you've heard of, the problem of consciousness, they separate into easy and the hard problems, although the easy problems are still super difficult. I'm going to say that the previous problems, which I'm terming more technical, are the easy ones. And so, of course, the next question becomes, okay, if those are easy, then what are the hard problems? And for that, I think that even if you look at the basic bare bones of the two theories, there's already something to be reconciled. So I want to, you know, what should we do if we start from just aiming to reconcile the fundamentals of a quantized theory of geometry? And so, do you know, if I don't want to shut everything off, this point is the laser, right? Because in some of them, they have this counterintuitive.
I think so.
Okay, yes. All right.
I don't really know.
So, you know, if you take the very naive view, you should think, well, quantum mechanics at least tells us about how a state evolves deterministically in time, and it should prescribe some frequencies for pointer states, given some initial setup, etc. And general relativity has a different type of theory, because it tells you, it's a theory about space-time, so it tells you about space-time geometries being compatible with distributions of energy and momentum, space-time distributions of energy and momentum. It is per se a theory that is not, is formulated in space-time language, not in the same language of evolution. Right. So I think this brings a clash between two, not between these two are perfectly fine between themselves, but between these two, and these two properties of quantum mechanics and two properties of general relativity, I've written them here because we might, I might reference them throughout the talk. And so just so you remember. So quantum mechanical properties, I have the quantum superposition principle, which I'm claiming has some non-trivial clash or something unintuitive that doesn't go really well together with having a fixed causal structure in GR, and an evolution in time of observables local in time, and here gravitational observables are known local in time, which is implied by space-time covariance. And this still leaves out the measurement problem in the foundations of quantum mechanics and its relevance for cosmology, but you know, I hope that resolving this will give us some hints, and I'll show you at the end of the talk what I think those are. Okay, so let me just give you an example of the first problem. It's a problem between quantum superposition and causal structure. We all know that matter sources gravity through T mu nu, and if you have some uncertainty in the position and momenta for matter, you have also, you should, if there's back reaction, you also need to have a superposition of G mu nu's, and that carries also their light cones. And what do we mean when we are talking about the superposition of light cones? It's not really clear. So, you know, the light, you're defining what is causally related itself. What does it mean for something to be over the same point and time? And so as an example, you just take the relativistic quantum field theory axiom that for operators with space-like separated support, they should commute. But space-like, using the word space-like, or the words space-like, presumes already a definite value for the very field we're trying to quantize. So it already, if you're talking about something that's space-like, you already presume that it's only defined with respect to that field which you want to look at superpositions of, gravity. So let me step back and think of a different way which I will try to frame superposition in. And that is, I'm claiming, I think this is more or less standard, I'm not quite sure, but that superposition is always observed from interference effects. At the end, that's how you get to observe superposition.
Just for clarification on the second blue line, do you mean that because the field determines the metric and the metric determines the notions of space-like separation, space-like presumes something about the field?
Right, okay. Yes, right.
When you say a definite value, is it clear that it has to be?
Well, a conformal class. So, you know, something that I'm going to aim for in maybe alleviating this conflict, assuaging it at least a little bit, is to frame superposition in terms of interference in quantum gravity. And now an example of the second problem is the evolution of observables. And this in GR, observables are generically non-local in time and space. So what does it mean to evolve a quantity that already depends on all of time? Should it be some transition between space-times? And this is very much intimately related with the problem of time. For those of you who have studied quantum gravity, of course, someone say, well, what happens if you gauge fix? The issue is exactly that, is that trine translations in GR are part of the gauge symmetries. And so a full gauge fixing would give you only a single instantaneous configuration, not really evolution. And moreover, there's no known gauge fixing that works generically for Lorentz metrics. You can do this for Euclidean. So basically this says, if you want to get to the spin 2 decomposition, usually when you construct a path integral for quantum gravity, for example, you want to get to the spin 2 decomposition, but the operators that you need to invert, which are killing, come from the killing form, they're not elliptic for Lorentzian metrics. So you can't use the usual trick to parametrize observables for Riemannian geometries. You can't use the same trick to parametrize Lorentzian form metrics. Unless you restrict your space of metrics to be Einstein and also for the whole space-time to satisfy CMC conditions. I'm not going to get too much into this. If you have questions about this, we can chat. I think this is one of the impediments if you really want to think about the metrics as Lorentzian, because if you're already restricting, the only way you know to do this already requires you to restrict to Einstein metrics, then What quantum effects do you expect?
Sorry, what is CMC?
It's a constant mean curvature. So it says that that you require spacetimes to have notions of time everywhere and at all times, which are equivalent to measuring the same expansion rate of space everywhere. This has a very special property, CMC, because in this, if you can do that in GR, you can decouple the dynamics of the scale degrees of freedom of the metric, so whatever refers to scale, and the scale free, only if you are in this gauge. And this is one of the things that leads us to shape dynamics, but this talk won't be about that. So, you know, local observables, then what do you do? You can ask Will, what do you do if you want to talk about local observables and gluing them in Lorentz? So, and this is a big issue in gravity. So, you know, to let me maybe try to get your interest before I start so we know where we're going. I want to have a meaningful transition amplitude between instantaneous observables in gravity. And paradoxically, this will be done in a timeless setting. I don't know if it's paradoxical. Anyways, I'll construct a wave function of the universe by anchoring a path integral in what will be well-defined as the least structured strata, least structured point in physical configuration space. It will replace a past hypothesis. So I want you to, well, there was a comment here. Maybe this is not the latest version. Anyways. You should think of something like the heart of Hawking here. And I'll show that as in the Mach bubble, you have standard notions of ordering and conservation of probability emerging from a timeless formulation. So if you don't know what the Mach bubble is and how it regains those things, I'll go over it. And in this framework, there is no really quantum collapse, and there is no problem of time. So, okay, the roadmap is, I'll start from describing the problem of evolution and talk about, instead of talking about theories that mix evolution with gauge symmetries, theories that separate evolution from gauge symmetries. That will lead us to a relational instantaneous space of observables. For gravity, this will be conformal superspace. There will be no notion of time. I'll need some semi-classical histories, and then I'll apply some analogy to relational configuration space to regain a notion of time. And right, this will be obtained from some path integral with preferred initial conditions. And from this path integral, I'll obtain an actual volume form in relational configuration space. And I'll try to interpret probabilities really in terms of volumes or numbers of copy, of relative numbers of copies of different outstates. And histories and probabilities will be abstracted from this volume. Okay, so this is basically the roadmap, but it's very cryptic, so you don't need to understand all these steps, just so that you know where we're going. So what would be first principles for a reduced configuration space of GR? What I mean by that is one that you can actually talk about quotienting by the symmetries. So as I said before, let's say you want a separation between law, whatever it is that you mean by physical law, and the objects the law act on. So a separation between evolution and the gauge symmetries. Here, I want to take them as fundamental, not space-time covariants. In a sense, I want instantaneous observables. And it turns out that you can show that for the configuration space of general relativity, which is the space of three remaining three metrics, you have that the fundamental symmetries of the theory are can be shown to be only the non-spurious one can be shown to be only spatial scale invariants and spatial diffeomorphisms. And so, for this talk, as it refers to gravity, I will take this a preferred basis of a sort of this theory, which I will take it to be conformal superspace. I will tell you in the next slide what conformal superspace is. But it's a preferred physical basis. It's what actually constitute the, I don't know if I'm using this correctly, the beables of the theory. But anyways, it's the preferred physical space of the theory. It's a relational configuration space, which will be conformal superspace. And I will try to frame superposition as interference of paths or coarse-grained paths in conformal superspace.
Why the space of equivalence classes of three metrics?
Yes, I will. This is the slide.
If you go back, why do you want separation between the law and the objects to law acta? That seems the opposite.
Well, it was my previous motivation. Huh? It was my previous motivation. It's about a clash between quantum mechanics and GR that I started off with.
Yes. Okay, well, maybe if you've said it already,
okay.
I won't ask you to repeat it.
All right, okay. We can talk about it after the talk, if you agree. So, as I said, so let's start from that. And conformal superspace is the space of conformal three geometries. So you can think of this as the space of spatial angles everywhere. It's what determines this space. It's a level of structure, roughly speaking, between a topology and geometry.
Sorry, so I just want to go back to the slide. Are you saying that you want space-time coherence? You're saying that should emerge. So you want to start off with things that actually explicitly break that?
No, I'm going to start with something for which that notion does not exist. Space-time does not exist here yet. I'm only in this space of conformal three geometries. And then you can read off a space-time in certain cases. For instance, if you couple the dynamics of a scalar field or something like that, you can read off the dynamics by defining what your duration is. So you have a one-parameter curve of three conformal geometries, for example, and then you can create a lapse, for example, by defining how things evolve with respect to the evolution of a scalar field, for example, or something like that in this space. So it's not clear, you know, it's something that Rojava always says. He says, no, this doesn't break Lorentz invariance. It never had Lorentz invariance. It doesn't break Lorentz invariance as much as it doesn't break, he calls it unicorn invariance. But so he says, like, yeah, the theory is not formulated in terms of a space-time. A space-time is regained through duration, through the dynamics of stuff. And in certain cases, you can regain space-times that are solutions of GR in the same way. So you regain the space-time.
You can also regain things that violate.
I'm sorry, what?
You would also regain things that violate local Lorentz invariance.
Yes, you might. You will, probably. I mean, if you want a more GR-centric motivation for this, I can go to the appendix. I have slides talking about this slice theorem for Lorentzian geometries and how you can get back to and why you need CMC and the interpretation of CMC in terms of evolution in conformal superspace. But I think that will deviate the talk too much towards the GR side. But I mean, I can go at it afterwards. So let's take conformal superspace as the space of configurations. And you can show, you know, the maximum group of non-spurious symmetries on metric configuration space giving a well-defined reduction, so forming a fiber bundle. It is true, this is not really a manifold per se. It's what's called a stratified manifold, and we will use that structure. But here you think of this group G as the group of everything that changes scale and shifts points around as conformal diffeomorphisms. And here this is the space, this is conformal superspace, the space that is determined by the conformal geometries, or by this, if you determine, you know, all the spatial angles around space, you will determine a point here. Okay, so now this starts more or less towards more the quantum mechanical part of it. So this is a space that I'm saying is a space of all relations. This space is already taking equivalence classes of things that, you know, that you're only comparing sizes and you're only taking things, positions relative to other positions. When you go to this quotient space, you already assume that these are the things that you're left with. But there is no time there. You know, time should be included. Time is part of the configuration. It's the clock on the wall, the fields that we interact with. There is no time in this space of all relations. And indeed, you know, there are two separate notions of time that we might want to recover. The first is just an ordering. It's just saying, well, this configuration came before that one in some abstract sense. And a second notion is the one that I was explaining about local duration. It's about relative evolution of subsystems within an ordering given above. And I will not talk about this one here in this talk. We can talk about it later, about how you couple different fields to obtain a notion of local duration. So let me just talk about the ordering, because I think it's more relevant for this topic. Where does it appear from? And so when does a timeless wave function, which I haven't yet defined, allow for the emergence of a linear ordering? And for this, we turn to the Mott bubble chamber. It gives us some guidance in this respect. So the Mott bubble chamber, I don't know how much you are familiar with it. It's they have a basically a radioactive element here and a chamber of condensed vapor, almost condensing vapor of water or something else. And whenever and it forms these tracks, because the radioactive element, when it radiates, it condenses molecules along its trajectory. That's the usual interpretation of it. But in the beginning of quantum mechanics, around 1923, Heisenberg, Bohr, a lot of people were wondering about this because you wanted to describe the radioactive element quantum mechanically. And the way you described it was through a spherically symmetric wave function. And so the question was, well, why doesn't it produce some, you know, spherically symmetric smearing of bubbles? Why doesn't it have some bubbles condense over here and over here? And why does it form these linear tracks directly from quantum mechanics? And so the way that you solve this, you actually do a time-independent Schrodinger equation. You do a perturbative expansion and interaction. You think of each one of these bubbles as having some finite radius of interaction, which I here wrote as F around, you know, position of bubble 2, whatever that label means, some radius of interaction here. And you expand psi itself also in terms of the number of bubbles that have been excited. And in the end, after you do the analysis, you do a semi-classical analysis or WKB analysis, and you obtain in the end that the probability, the amplitude for exciting n bubbles is actually obtained from having, you know, the first bubble here excited, and then a linear the Green's function, the free Green's function for this configuration to be transported to that configuration, and so on and so forth. And if you do a semi-classical approximation in this, you find that the momenta or the gradient of the Hamilton-Jacobi or the phase needs to be collinear. So you do find that for n bubbles to be excited, it is preferred if they are all along the same classical trajectory. And this is what Mott found. So an approximately classical history here appears from a timeless quantum mechanical setting. And the ingredients that we need, that I will borrow for my analysis, is that there's a very asymmetric boundary condition in a way. There's an origin in configuration space. And you also use a semi-classical approximation, a WKB. So here's this, you know, there's an analogy with the Hartle-Hawking proposal. So in Hartle-Hawking, you also have a wave function of the universe. You have, you know, you single out, it's defined by basically propagating something from G naught to H. The exponential here is the Einstein-Hilbert action for a space-time that has these boundaries. Of course, you know, the interpretation is that one of these is not a boundary. It's just a half disk of some sort. And indeed, it is a sort of a many worlds view. So the sense is that all of these actually, it exists. And if you want to calculate probabilities for something happening, you condition on our records, on things that we see around us. And I would take, this is very similar to what I'm trying to do, because so it has some pros, and these are the ones that I will also borrow. In their case, you have instantaneous three metrics which form the configuration space, and there can be an origin. So I will use these two things. It works well in systems with high symmetry, meaning superspace and under semi-classical approximation. But it has problems. So the Born rule does not seem to be the right choice, because here it's the same thing. There is no external time variable under which this should be conserved. There are only the three metrics. This is something pointed out by Halliwell, and he tried to amend that by talking about fluxes in field space, etc. And it really works only even theoretically if you look at the details. And this is something pointed out by Kukash in his review of 91, that it really, this proposal really works very well when you have already truncated field space. And you know, lately people here at PI have been saying that even then it doesn't really work. Well, it's falsified. Okay. So I'm trying to do something like that, something that relates to Hartle-Hawking and to Mott in my relational configuration space. And given some action functional on curves and configuration space Q, which respects my given symmetry group, which here are spatial diffs and spatial conformal transformations, I can also define a wave function. I will not tell you exactly how it is defined. I don't really use a gauge fixing. I use something slightly different that's more adapted to this type of theories of field history. So I use basically a notion of horizontal lifts. It is, in a sense, kind of a gauge fixing of velocity. So when people gauge fix the laps and shift, it's something similar to this. So you choose some curve, or for any given curve here, you have a unique lift of this curve starting from a given point here. In any case, the important point is that I define a wave function from a transition amplitude, but from some singled out anchor that I'm calling here, which you know I haven't defined. And this is the next problem. So these are things that you get, but I think I'm not going to use. Perhaps I will use a semi-classical approximation. But the issue is, what selects the anchor of the wave function? You know, for Hartle-Hawking, they say, well, what selects is that there is no boundary. In my case, I'll have a different principle. And this principle comes from the notion of stratified manifolds. So here you see, you know, the strata, and you can actually tell time by counting the rings, the strata in this strata in the stratified geological rock. And the point is that the topology of the base spaces, when you have gauge theories, is very rich. It is actually a union, a nested union of manifolds. So, how long do I have? We started a bit late. Okay, good. Okay, so let me just very quickly tell you what a stratified manifold is. Suppose you're in field space and you want to take a quotient to your base space. You're in a quotient by your symmetries, right? So what you end up, so there are some configurations in your field space which have, let's say, it has a higher isometries, a subgroup of isometries. So for example, a metric that has Killing vectors, right? So in all these other points, you have the full group of diffeomorphisms acting on it and moving it up and down. For groups that have non-trivial isometries, you don't have the full group of things that are moving it up and down, let's say, but some of them don't move this point at all. They leave it fixed, right? Because if it has a Killing vector field, it doesn't change the metric. And so when you take the quotient, so you know, now suppose I want to take the quotient, I get some other manifold. And what you find is that the metrics that have no, or the fields, for, if it was gauge fields, substitute killing vector fields by a metric that has isometries to a gauge connection that is reducible. What you find is that there are, so there's a bulk of this space. Let me write it like this. I'm going to write it like a bottomless pyramid. Okay. So this is not really, it doesn't stop here. But there's a bulk of this space that corresponds to all the metrics that have no killing vector fields. And then it is bounded by metrics that have a slightly bigger group of killing vector fields. And that space is bounded by another manifold. So it's a concatenation of manifolds. You put these manifolds together. And this manifold here is bounded by one that has slightly more killing vector fields and so on, until you reach an element that has the most amount of killing vector fields. And that is indeed topologically different. It's a manifold of a different dimension that is being glued to the boundaries of all these other manifolds of different dimensions. Does anybody get that? Or does anybody not understand that? So in this case, okay. So let me repeat what I just said. The more homogeneous the configurations, the smaller the dimension of the respective strata. Okay? So as you add symmetries, you're going to have these configurations that correspond to strata of smaller and smaller dimension. Until you reach a least dimensional strata, the corner of reduced configuration space, the corner of all corners of reduced configuration space. It can be more than a point, but in my case, in this case of the Riemannian metrics with conformal diffeomorphisms, if the topology of the spatial manifold or the manifold is S3, there's a unique corner, which is it corresponds to the equivalence class of the conformal round sphere. And this is things that you guys probably are not interested in genus points. But in any case, let's suppose now I anchor my amplitude I anchor my wave function of the universe as a transition amplitude between this corner of reduced configuration space to any other metric. And an ordering now can be obtained very much as in the Mott case. You know, I have an origin in physical configuration space. I can do semi-classical approximations to the wave function that I obtain, and I can find out what the distribution of amplitudes in this case. So I'm going here slightly beyond Mott, and this is, you know, in the paper, this is, I'm also describing some coarse graining, so it's not that simple. But if you think of if all the paths that reach this configuration, or the coarse graining of paths that reach this configuration, actually pass through a path in between here, this is the origin, the anchor. You can then show again that the semi-classical transition amplitude also decomposes from going from here to here and here to here. It's and this is kind of like a conditional amplitude. And you can have multiple such records for technical reasons, for the semi-classical approximation to work, the records themselves need to have some separation so that, you know, for this to be a record of this as well, and all of these to be a record of these. This is how I'm defining a record, is through all these coarse grained paths going through some intermediary configurations to reach a final configuration. So this configuration has a record of all these other ones, where this is the anchor. And you can have other cases in which you still have this decomposition. In this case, you don't have this decomposition because the ordering between the coarse grained paths doesn't match. In any case, for instance, for this example here, it's precisely as we had in Mott, and the proof becomes very similar. But what I wanted to also show is that imagine I have two configurations here. So this is the anchor, This is what I'm saying is the base of the space. It works kind of like a past hypothesis because the least structured one, it has the one that has the most conformal Killing vector fields. It's very homogeneous, and it's also, you know, topologically differentiated, they're topologically different. And suppose, you know, these two configurations have the same region of records here. If I want to calculate the amplitude here, and if I take ratios of the two amplitudes, the amplitude to go from here to here disappears in this ratio. And so it's kind of, I don't know what a forgetful functor is, but it just forgets that part. Someone mentioned to me that, anyways, let's move forward. Okay, so what is the meaning of probabilities in this framework?
Sorry, it didn't come out across to me clearly what exactly you're assuming. I mean, in the Mott case, there's an assumption, I guess, of a source at the origin or something. There's some boundary condition on the wave function.
Right.
Which basically puts the source at the origin.
Right.
And you're solving the time-dependent Schrodinger equation.
Time-independent
Schrodinger equation. And
right.
A superposition of rays, or whatever you want to call it.
Right. So in this case...
Now, in this case, what is the analog of the boundary? I mean, in that case, the center was picked out because you put a certain boundary condition.
Right. So
what is the analog of the time-independent Schrodinger equation?
No, so
the analog of the boundary condition.
Right. So I don't. I have. So the analog of the. I don't. I. Instead of the time dependent, I'm using a semi-classical, the path integral, the semi-classical transition amplitude between a point that I'm identifying as a preferred boundary, like you just mentioned. So this is what I call the anchor. Is a point that is topologically identified in conformal superspace.
So it's an assumption that everything begins, so to speak, at the most highly symmetric
right.
space or conformal space.
Right. Yeah.
Okay. And then you're using some path integral or some semi-classical path.
Right. Semi-classical. Exactly. Yes.
The assumption of semi-classicality. Can you go into that some more? What exactly it is a path integral, or is it different from a path integral? Like what's the, when you say we make a semi-classical approximation, wait, what are you assuming?
So, okay.
Maybe in the Mott case would be the simplest. Like in the Mott example, when they say, let's do a semi-classical approximation.
Right, they assume that it's of a WKB form. The wave function is of some, it is some, so there's an assumption that the phase, varies slowly with respect to the norm and
assumption about the propagator.
Sorry? Yes.
So you use the saddle point, you know, version for the propagator instead of using the full quantum.
So you get contributions just from the classical paths.
And right, and fluctuations around the classical paths.
So the idea in the Mott case is this is a good approximation for the parameters of that particular experiment where we have...
Yeah, so right. So usually, you know, if you...
That we don't think is fundamental, but just gives me an answer that's going to be close to the answer I would have gotten if I'd used...
It is... Cool. So for instance, in the Mott case, it is... If the on-shell action, so the Hamilton-Jacobi function, the action on the paths themselves are greater than h bar, so for a given path here, in the Mott case, if it's greater than h bar, then the semi-classical approximation is good up to orders of.
But it should depend on the number n of of records. I think otherwise it's...
No, right. So, no, right. So this is...
Subtle conditions.
Right. So this is just what...
For a high number of...
No, right. So this is... I'm just saying this is a good approximation for Q... Between QI and QF. So I'm saying that this... So what you do, if you want to write, you know, the path integral, what you do is you just say you expand... It's a Taylor expansion of S in terms of the classical solutions of S here. So what you get, you know, you get the first one, you would get, so for the first, you just get the classical action. And then for the second one, you'd get the second derivative of the action and orders of h bar. And that, and this second derivative of the on-shell action comes into this when you write it. You write del squared of the on-shell action in terms of the first and the second, the determinant of this. Maybe there's an inverse here, half inverse, I don't remember. And then here is the EI of the on-shell action. And this is just, this is called the von Vleck determinant. It's just an approximation of the transition amplitude for points that have at least one classical path. You could have a summation here. For if you have many classical paths that interpolate, you'd have a summation, one phase for each and one von Vleck determinant. And it's valid if these points are reasonably separated in terms of the on-shell action.
There must be, I mean,
is there a condition on the number of record you need to have before it's a valid one?
Right, so... Yeah, no, so that's it's something that I said as well. So if the distance between, so the way that I, so the difference between the distance, in the same way, the distance between this original point and any record needs also to be great in that respect. So it's kind of a granular history.
From my perspective, like a measurement theory perspective, if I thought of the bubble chamber, mm-hmm. in terms of sort of the modern theory of quantum measurements, where we don't just have projective measurements, but we have POVMs, and they can be weak or strong. So if I had a bunch of concentric rings, and they were all extremely weak measurements of angle, then I don't necessarily see a straight path. I can imagine the thing just sort of bouncing around because my estimate of the angle, you know, is actually a very poor estimate. So even though it's a passing here, I just get some random angle. So I could have it, you know, not following a line by virtue of all the measurements being too weak. And also, conversely, if all the measurements are extremely strong, you know, I localize the particle too much, I impart momentum, and it starts bouncing around in a zigzag because the measurements are deflecting it. So there's only a sort of a region that's not too strong and not too weak where I expect straight path motion. And I just don't know how to convert that condition into the language of, you know, when I expect the action of these trajectories to be... large compared
it
to
it does. For instance, imagine that you have lots of measurements. So all these points are very thin. Then this action, especially ISO, is very small. And therefore, your semi-classical limit is wrong, right? So then you cannot, if you make lots of recalls along the path, then
right.
You know, the semi-classical limit is not going to be satisfied. So that is completely in agreement with what you were saying about making soft measurements. You don't want to have too fine of a record of your path,
right.
But then you can make it follow absolutely any path. You
exactly. Right.
Because otherwise, this amplitude is not going to be suppressed. For it to be suppressed, you want the record to be coarse enough so that it accumulates lots of phases if it deviates from the classical.
Right. So here's more or less how I know it's very brief, but I was translating it like this, that it needs to be far enough apart that... Each one of these records needs to be far enough apart for them to fall.
For the other one, the strong, it's harder. The notion of a strong measurement, I don't know.
Huh?
The notion of a strong measurement, it's harder to see how you model it in semi-classical.
You know, I think it has to do with
the distance.
It just has to be.
It has to do with the coupling, I think, between, like, you know, your bubble chamber involves a Hamiltonian that couples the particle to the matter in the bubble chamber.
Mm-hmm.
And it's about the strength of that coupling. The dial I was just talking about turning was really a dial concerning the strength.
But if you have a strong coupling, the action will be huge, so it's the same. So you need a short.
It's an action distance.
It's an action. So the action measures the strength of both the distance between the two points, the records, and the strength of the probe. So here is in the limit where it's assuming that all the measurements are very soft. So there's no. If you want to make a strong measurement, you would have to put an extra pump in there. It's just following the. Yeah.
Right.
Or I have a propagator, which is a background propagator. That I think in your case, you're just looking at very soft measurements. Right.
Well, in this case, I'm thinking of it as a closed system in field space. So I'm thinking of this semi-classical trajectory. So it's the same thing here. The issue is that if I want to translate this action distance into configuration distance, then the coupling constant comes in. And this involves the long action distance between two points. Does that make sense? On-shell action is big between two points.
Let me take it on faith that this all works out. Maybe a more important question would be, so there are certain situations in which, you know, these semi-classical approximations will be good approximations.
Right.
And other situations where they're not.
Absolutely.
It seems to me you're building in as a kind of, it's necessary that these semi-classical approximations make sense in order for this notion.
So good question.
Okay.
No, I'm not saying that.
Oh.
I'm saying that this notion of, so this notion of records that I'm using does require that. There might be something else that doesn't require it. This notion of records that I'm using does require that. And I'm not saying that you always can abstract time. I'm saying when this happens, you can abstract some notion of ordering.
So you're saying it might not happen.
Yeah. Okay. There are many configurations in configuration space that, which are not connected to this anchor in such a way, for example, you can have no classical paths connecting them. Or if it's too close to the anchor, or there are a bunch of things that can happen.
Let me just follow up and press that a little more. In the Mott case, there must be an assumption about the energy of the emitted particle. If it's too small, then this won't work. If it's sufficiently large, presumably it's okay. But there's something, in other words, you must have an analog of that here. I don't know if it's implicitly, you're assuming a kind of initial delta function by itself. I mean, that would be a false idealization, but is that basically, it has to be sufficiently close to a delta function, or what exactly?
So you're talking about the initial condition, if I was to describing it. Yeah, so, I mean, it is, so I'm defining my wave function through a transition amplitude between a single configuration and any other. So it is kind of assuming a similar assumption, I don't know, in fact. There are all these issues, you know, for the Hartle-Hawking, how do you translate the boundary conditions of the Euler-DeWitt equation into the formulation of Hartle-Hawking? Nobody really knows how to do this. But heuristically speaking, it should be something like assuming a delta function in this initial condition.
If you assume much like a delta function, you'll probably disrupt space-time altogether. Something like that, you'll excite all the modes that are completely inhomogeneous and so on.
Right, and in fact, you know, if you get too close to this anchor, as I said, there is no notion of extremality. So you would, at least this notion of extremality doesn't work. It doesn't focus the wave function enough. So you wouldn't have something like, at least this notion of time, you wouldn't be able to abstract a notion of space-time when you're close to the anchor in configuration space. So the idea is this. You have this amplitude, the static amplitude on configuration space. Suppose here's the anchor. And, you know, here you can't really distinguish anything, but once you get far enough away, you kind of start getting things like that.
Yeah, I mean, I might be wrong, but I'm saying something a little different from that. I'm saying, I think you need a slightly smeared out delta function. And there must be some place in the formalism where that's
right.
entering.
Right. So there's also a role about coarse graining that I haven't really talked
yeah.
about yet. Right. That's true. Okay. So let me just. Now I don't have so much time, right?
You can continue. It's fine.
Like, okay.
Some from the question.
Okay, so you know, here time is emergent. What should be the meaning of probabilities? And I particularly like a definition of probability that comes from Feynman, and he says it's our best estimate of ratios of outcomes. In fact, that's not what he says. He says this: our best estimate of future frequencies of outcomes. Okay, and this would be my interpretation of what I'm thinking of probabilities. And I want to interpret ratios, the word ratios here, as ratios between actual numbers of outcomes or infinite volumes of configurations. So volume elements will be defined by a positive function of my wave function. So something like f of psi and some volume, infinitesimal volume element here in configuration space. And best estimate is defined by the theory itself. So a choice of action, everything else that gives you through something like this, a volume form in configuration space. So you know, I'm saying that given some positive function on your amplitude here, you'll be able to define a volume form, and this will inform us what it means to have your best estimate. Of course, the wave function, everything depends on choices, depends on choice of action, for instance, are we using standard model or whatever it is. And this will define a volume form in configuration space. And then you can, my interpretation here would be that doing a Bayesian updating, if according to your own volume form that you have constructed here, I haven't described, I will describe more or less what you do here. According to your own volume form, if you find yourself in a highly untypical configuration, so small relative volume according to your best estimate, will lead you to reconsider or diminish credence on your theory, on your action function, on all these things. So suppose, you know, your theory predicts that all these configurations here that have similar records that you have in your theory, and your theory predicts there's almost no volume here and all the volume here. So if you assume that you're typical, or that your configuration is typical, not even that you're typical, then, and you find yourself in the one that has very little volume with respect to your theory, you say, well, actually my theory is probably wrong, or it's probably not as correct as I thought. You diminish credence on it. I'm not gonna dwell too much on it. I don't know how contentious this is, but. And in fact, you can give other conditions for which the a Born measure of volume is uniquely identified from positive functions on reduced configuration space. I have a proof in the appendix if you guys want to go over it. It assumes some Markovian property of the probabilities that follows the kind of forgetfulness property of the amplitudes with records, and then you can show that the if there's just a single function that takes complex numbers into positive numbers for configuration space, it is given by the Born rule. Well, there's a whole story about the measure that I don't need to get into, but we can later. But still, you know, this is the same problem that Halliwell had to face in the Hartle-Hawking case, is that there's no time here, but you still want to define somehow conservation of probability. And we associate conservation of probability with conservation in time. So, and the problem is that, you know, suppose I have a single record of this configuration contains a record here, but I could, if I'm counting all the volumes of all the configurations that have as this configuration as a record, I'm going to be counting records of records, I'm going to be counting this configuration here, but this configuration is also a record of this configuration. This configuration also contains a record of this configuration. So one way to approach the question of conservation or probability, and again, if you're interested in the details, we can also go to the appendix after the talk. But if you restrict subsets in configuration space for which no element is a record of another, so you can see something like this, this element here, this element is, any element in this screen is not a record of the other. You have records along this direction, records of records. But these subsets here, they're not records of each other. And then you can actually find that there's a volume gradient or a flux of volume that is conserved. So you can actually say, well, the volume of this screen here is smaller than the volume of this screen. And you can, from that relation between volumes, you can abstract a conservation of probability. It's an inequality, in fact. It's not strict conservation that you get because you're also dealing with a semi-classical approximation. But, you know, it's something.
Which one is greater? I didn't see it.
So the flux here, so the volume here would be greater than the volume here, if this is the anchor.
So you may lose probability, lose flux as evident.
Right. You may lose flux up to some order if it doesn't saturate, you know. And so an example that I've...
Is that like a possible violation of unitarity?
Maybe, but the issue is that... So I have conditions in the paper. If you look at conditions, I have conditions under which the let's say it like this. If you were able to account for all the extremal paths that are going through this screen here, on this screen here, then the probability would be conserved up to orders of some element. So an example, I don't know how many of you here are aware of this paradox of the Sleeping Beauty. Probably Quantum Foundations people are aware. Do you know it, Rafael?
Not by that name.
No?
Is it Lev Feynman's or?
I'm not sure.
An Elgin
philosopher. Huh?
From philosophers.
From philosophers, okay. Okay, so you don't care about this, okay? No, I actually know about this because I saw some discussion in a paper on quantum foundations by Sean Carroll and some other people about self-locating uncertainty. And actually, this is taken, I should have referenced it. This is taken from that paper. So the Sleeping Beauty paradox, for those of you who have never heard of it, is the following. You take Sleeping Beauty and you say, look, we're going to put you to sleep, we're going to throw a coin, we're going to put you to sleep, and then we're going to throw a quantum coin, a spin coin. And if the spin comes up, we'll wake you up on Monday, and you won't be able to tell it's Monday. There will be nothing in the room that tells you it's Monday. And then we'll put you back to sleep. You'll forget that you woke up on Monday, and you will wake up again on Tuesday. If, on the other hand, the spin comes up down, we will only wake you up on Monday. So the question is, if you wake up Sleeping Beauty, what probability should she assign that the spin came up and the spin came up down? Should it be one half, or should it be half and half, or two thirds and one third? That's usually the question that is posed, right? Because here one would think, well, she's being... There are two events in which she has been woken up, and so if she's woken up, she should say, well, the probability that the spin came up is two-thirds and not one-third. Anyways, this is something people actually discuss, so I know it doesn't sound very paradoxical, maybe, I don't know.
It's usually with just classical coin flips.
Just the classical coin flips? Okay.
Most of the discussion is about that case. There's already a puzzle there.
Okay.
So what you're going to say is important that it is all quantum, I presume.
Yes.
Then that you could call that the quantum version of the Sleeping Beauty problem, which is
okay.
Distinct.
Okay. The quantum.
What's the answer in the classical case.
Well, many world. So, for instance, many worlders say actually that the two thirds, not in the classical case.
It's disputed. There's
different
philosophies for what the correct
is. It disputed like Monty Hall, where it's not actually disputed, like there's actually
no
an answer.
It's not. It's not like Monty Hall. And here, I think the distinction becomes more or less clear. Because if you're thinking of just volumes in configuration space, it is true that the spin up configuration, the configurations that have spin up in as a record, and she's being woken up, have twice the volume where she's being woken up and the spin was down. But this is not the right notion of this is not the notion of probability that is conserved. If you were to take any screen here and use the conservation of probability as given by a screen, or the notion of probability that is conserved, then you would find that there would be a volume here and a volume here, and they're roughly the same size. So according to the type of probability that is conserved through screens, you have conservation of probability, but the volume of the configurations where the spin is seen to be up is twice the volume. And of course, I should point out that there's a difference between betting and assigning probability. Of course, if someone wants to say what do you bet on to Sleeping Beauty? Do you bet that the spin came up or that the spin came up down? Obviously, she should bet that the spin came up because she would get paid twice. Every time that the spin comes up, she would get paid twice, right? Here, so if she bet, if she gets woken up here, and she bets all the spin didn't come up, she would lose this bet. But if she bets every time she wakes up, she bets the spin came up in this branch, she would get paid twice. So in betting, it's the correct answer should be I assign more probability to spin up them.
Unless she only gets paid once on Wednesday or something.
Yes, I'm saying that they pay her as she wakes up, right? And the confusion also disappears if you have something like that, because then this is not a record of this one, and then there is no paradox. People agree. Right. So let me just summarize. I haven't really shown you. I mean, we can talk about it, but this was an overview. That the Born density is unique under certain extra assumptions. And it's not true that without fundamental time, the Born density gives you some conservation of probability. So this does not follow. But if I have some Born density and an ocean of screens of records, I have conservation of semi-classical probability. All of these are understood in the semi-classical sense. And something that I have entirely not shown you here, but we can go over the proof for a geodesic model in conformal superspace, is that if you have a weak matter couplings and a gravitational classical background, you in the semi-classical approximation, the WKB approximation, you find that the action function of the metric itself decouples, solves a Hamilton-Jacobi sort of equation, and that defines you these classical backgrounds. And in fact, when you try to in this expansion, you also have a standard Schrödinger wave equation for the matter Hamiltonian in the background ordering given by the geometry. It's not a trivial calculation, but we can go over it if you want. So let me conclude. I have argued for a meaningful transition amplitude between observables in time. I should have quoted that. Because this was done in a timeless setting. I have constructed a wave function of the universe by anchoring a path integral in the least structured strata. And in a sense, this would be a replacement for the past hypothesis. And as in the Mott bubble, the standard notions of ordering conservation of probability can emerge from this formulation. This is something about the preferential status of conformal superspace. And shape dynamics is a formulation of GR that takes place in conformal superspace. And here, just to finish it, you know, okay, so what? Can we do something with it? And here I would take this opening that Neo and Job have reinforced lately, is that Hartle-Hawking has many problems. And what about here? Here we also have kind of a homogeneous smooth beginning to space-time. It's not really a beginning to space-time because, as we said, there might be no notion of space-time close to this point. But it's a corner of physical configuration space. And but there are problems here as well with performing the standard path integral, Lorentzian path integral mini superspace using Picard-Lefschetz theory for cosmologies. Because in mini superspace is the space of homogeneous geometries and has no shape degrees of freedom. So we're starting this project now where we're using quiescent Bianchi 9, which can interpolate between the three sphere. And you know, there's something called the Misner variables that you can parameterize variables in terms of shape degrees of freedom, and then you can try to follow the same calculation for quantum cosmology that was done originally by Hartle-Hawking in this slightly non-homogeneous case. And yeah, thank you.
So I'm curious how the beginning part of your talk, or if it differs from Julian Barber's proposal. So it seemed very reminiscent of his proposal that there's no time, there's just these time capsules in a given configuration that have kind of
appearance
of time, and then in a quantum theory we could write down a wave function over the relational configuration space to give us the relative probabilities. So it's you start there, and then you have a particular proposal for how to compute that wave function?
Yes.
Is that the idea?
Well, the problem is, if you were here, he was in the audience the last time I gave this talk, and he disavows, so he doesn't really think like that anymore. I thought, yes, it is a more or less concrete realization of some of his ideas, like the time capsules one and so on. But he doesn't think like that. He doesn't think that there, at least he doesn't think of the, he thinks more in terms of the Wheeler-DeWitt equation and finding some unique solution for the Wheeler-DeWitt equation in terms of boundary conditions, etc. So it's just like, it's a different.
Isn't that what you're doing? I don't see, why is that not what you're doing?
Because I was defining it through the path integral.
I mean, it's all at a very formal level.
Right.
But is there some reason, this will come up, I suppose, next week again, but is there some reason why you are producing a wave function. You're saying at each point of your configuration space,
right,
the wave function should be given by
right.
the propagator from the sphere, three sphere, to
right.
mm-hmm. point.
Right. No, you're right. So this wave function.
You don't have, it's true, you don't have.
Reparametrization event.
You have only conformal information in your. So I'm not sure exactly what the Wheeler-DeWitt equation means in that setting. But assuming you could make contact with it,
mm-hmm.
would it not be true that formally one could at least argue
yes.
by hand waving
yes.
the wave function you define
yeah.
does solve the Wheeler-DeWitt equation?
But not the local one, yes. Because here.
Yes, but no.
So the Wheeler-DeWitt equation is one equation per point.
Yes.
In this case, if you define these action functionals to have the right number of degrees of freedom, for example, you only have a single global reparametrization constraint that gives you a single Wheeler-DeWitt equation. So there's.
It will violate almost all of the Wheeler-DeWitt equations. Is that what you're saying? Or are you saying that you can't make sense of them? Until you include the conformal information, conformal factor.
Right. So I mean, the Wheeler-DeWitt equation is an equation that translates to the quantum regime, local reparametrization invariance. Right. So I'm saying here that reparametrization invariance
Well, you could just say it's a Gauss law,
Right, but the
you can use those words that it has to do with time.
Right.
Geomorphisms that change mm-hmm. time and so on.
Right.
It's just a well-defined.
Yeah, in this case, so I could say it like this. In this case, you only have a global sort of Wheeler-DeWitt equation defined by this path integral. It depends on the action that you have and how you're actually going to get to that global version of the Wheeler-DeWitt equation. I look at it for a particular, so basically for a Jacobi action functional on this conformal superspace. And then you'd get something like...
There's some basic confusion. The Wheeler-DeWitt equation is an equation normally on a space of three metrics.
Mm-hmm. Right.
So that includes not just conformal three metrics, but it includes also the conformal factor.
Right.
The root minus g if you want, or the root plus g.
Yes.
So are you getting a wave function depending on those variables, or is it depending only on
conformal
metrics?
No, so to actually get, so if I go back.
Because if you do a semi-classical treatment, then you should have perhaps also the full three metric.
The full three metric. No, so the way that I define the wave function, the way that you actually define it, it isn't, so you define it, you don't define it for a conformal three metric. You define it for a three metric.
Oh, okay.
And then you have the invariances that come from the definition of the action and how you've defined this wave function. So there are these two equations that wave function satisfies. So this is the translation of the diff invariance, and this is the translation of the conformal invariance. And then these are local equations. These are for psi of h at x, psi h at x. And then for, depending on the type of action that I put in, I will, if I want this action to be also globally reparametrization invariant, so it doesn't depend on the global parameter of these curves, then I will also get another equation that is a global conservation equation for psi.
Maybe
But that's a local, you've written local equations.
Yes, these are local. So these are local symmetries.
They're either compatible with the Wheeler-DeWitt equation or they're not. So are you saying that they're not?
Yeah, I'm saying I don't know. I think they might not be.
Well, they might. I said we don't know. They might be.
Yeah, right.
And they might not. But that's one for every x, is that right?
Yes, these are ones for every x. I'm saying is that there is a classical theory that can match GR dynamically, but doesn't have the same fundamental local gauge symmetries. So,
what are the classical solutions of this action? Are they GR solutions, or are they?
This action that I looked at, no. But shape dynamics is a more complicated one that you can get.
I mean, the one you really believe in, not necessarily a toy. But
yes, then you get many solutions of GR. The GR solutions that have complete CMC foliations, you can get those solutions.
So would you then, if you could work that out, would you expect to get a solution of the Wheeler-DeWitt equation?
But I don't understand. I mean, that is a classical solution,
no,
right?
I mean, if you did your semi-classical Wheeler-DeWitt.
Yeah.
Some order h bar to the zero or something.
Yeah, I suppose I would.
I don't see that much difference between the if it's still his view.
Well, I don't know. We should ask Julian. We can have him on the Skype because he definitely doesn't. I think, yeah. So he never stipulated what are time capsules and how they should. For him, time capsules are something that really incorporate a lot of structure. Physical structure that we could somehow tell time by. Here it's more of a mathematical definition, for example. So there are those differences. And he doesn't really think of an anchor of wave function. So I don't think he would agree with the boundary condition. If we're thinking about it in terms of boundary conditions, I don't think he would agree.
I was just asking it in connection with the
right.
question.
Yeah.
That's sort of the underlying philosophical, the attitude towards
Yeah, I think the attitude is right. No, I think that's probably correct. The attitude is yes, very similar. I thought you would be very happy about this, but in any case.
Okay. No more. Okay. Last question.
So yeah, maybe it's more of a comment than a question. I'm not sure, but so you could do most of this, I think, totally classically. So I'm thinking, for example, in the bubble chamber example, I could say, well, look, the particles, maybe there's a massive particle, and instead of the fluid, I just have a bunch of smaller particles. And I know that initially the mass of particles in the center, and at some final time, it's on the edge. And then I say, all right, well, classical mechanics tells me what the possible trajectories are of that particle and all the others, but it says that the action should be extremized. So I could just ask, out of all the possible final configurations of my dust particles, which are the ones that correspond to extremizing the action? And I would find, straight lines of the massive particle in all different directions.
But you could also get...
extremize the action.
Right, but here you can also get interference. So for instance, if your coarse-grained paths, if there are two that interpolate between an initial and final configuration, you could have that the volume at that final configuration is near zero, for example. There is interference through this... extremized coarse-grained paths.
Sure. So your probabilities will be different if you do the quantum case. And so your idea is that, so for some of what you said, you require the semi-classical approximation, which is not quite the same as being fully classical, but I suspect it's not fully quantum either, in the sense that for those approximations, you're unlikely to see things like Bell inequality violations and strong signatures of non-classicality. We don't normally describe those in a pathological formulation. So my conjecture is that if you've got a semi-classical path integral, then you don't have the Bell inequality violations.
You could describe those in a path integral.
Sorry?
You could describe those in a path integral.
It's just
a semi-classical path integral.
Right.
And you have to remember that these are paths in configuration space. They're not the paths of single particles, right? Each path of these includes...
Yeah.
And it's going everywhere and includes the configuration of the two particles or whatever.
So you made these comments about what follows if we allow a semi-classical approximation in our path integral expressions. And then we have some notion of, time capsules and what occurred. But in the most strongly quantum examples, that semi-classical approximation will fail. And therefore, the story about time capsules will fail in those cases. Now, so my question is that a benefit in your point of view, that stories that involve a kind of ordering over time, should we expect them to fail in when things are strongly quantum?
Right. So you're the expert in what calls strongly quantum, but I don't think that, for instance, Bell pairs, I don't think they escape this. I think the strongly quantum here would be effects that are if you have if we start talking about more than one loop effects, for example, then I think they would be strongly
quantum. So I have a different notion of strongly quantum in mind, I think, than you. For the purpose of this discussion, let's say take an example where the semi-classical approximation is not a good approximation. Okay.
Okay.
Right. So there are such examples where the actual dynamics is very different.
Right.
From what you get after you make that semi-classical approximation. Okay. So it's not a good approximation.
Like tunneling or something like that.
So in those examples, the story you gave about how we can tell. We have a notion of time ordering and a kind of notion of trajectories and so forth, that breaks down.
Yes, right.
And my point is that those are the examples that are most interesting from a quantum gravity perspective, because they're the ones that are most quantum. When the semi-classical approximation breaks down, that's a good thing if you're looking for truly quantum effects. So those are the examples in which stories about how things proceed over time won't work in your picture.
So I don't know. It depends on what you. So, for instance, for quantum cosmology, for example, I don't know if those are encompassed by what you call most quantum. In this respect. And I don't. there is a whole other story here about how do you do regularization in this picture and those sorts of things in conformal superspace. How does it work when you're quotienting by what is the measure? How do you quotient volumes and that sort of thing? I think there are advantages there, but I don't have concrete results to say about that. But I mean, maybe you have to explain to me exactly what you mean by the most quantum. I think that in certain cases, when you really have quantum, what you lose is a definite notion of time or a definite notion of this type of time. And I usually was thinking about this as, you know, I don't know if that's good or bad. I think it might be good. I don't know. It's time here is something that emerges only in certain, or what we describe as time emerges only in certain portions of configuration space.
Okay, that's
time
coming again.